compete with, for instance, the Frozen song?
Well, I want to compete in haram. But, like, I mean, even jurisprudentially talking, there are music that I consider to be halal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's not suitable for lahu, ghina, or raqs, or all the criteria they put. If it's just for kids, just for learning, just, you know, nice music, we can go with it if we have to stay within the limits of halal and haram. Obviously, there are types which are not considered to be haram that we can use. Sometimes just anthems themselves, or what you call nasheed. Back in the day, we used to have a lot of nasheed. Now we have a nasheed with a bit of music in it as well. But itself, it draws in children. And it's a method to teach them things, right? So like I said, something that we cannot overlook. That's what I'm trying to get at.
Okay, thanks. We're going to take a break now, and then we'll continue our discussion just after the break. Don't go away.
When I was born, the first words that I had heard were the words of Allah being whispered through my ear. And as I felt Allah's presence in my soul, that day Islam took me in its fold.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about the methods to use, the methods that we need for raising our children. So just before the break, you talked about songs and how effective they can be because they draw the children to themselves.
Mm.
What's the next method that we're going to be learning about?
Next method is, this is like even, it's been used through the psychology, is that what we call your subconscious. So the fifth method would be talking to the child in his sleep.
Oh.
So a lot of people don't pay attention to this, right? And a lot of people, and sadly, this is even a Quran concept when Allah says, when he talks about children, when they about to grow up, and Allah says, you know, they trying to reach adulthood, says, do not let them come into the times where you are in bed and let them knock, right? So don't let them allow them in the room. Sometimes parents have kids in their rooms while they're being intimate together because they think the child is asleep. The fact is, scientifically, the mind, the body is asleep, but the mind is still active.
Still collecting information.
Collecting information. So whatever he hears, it goes to his brain, right? So we need to be very mindful of that concept. Even from a young age, you need to put a child in a different room. If, obviously, a person is to be intimate with his wife. What I'm trying to get at is that the child hears. So what they do is that sometimes they make you listen to messages while you're asleep. For example, if you have the Quran, I always, for example, this is what I do. I always turn the Quran on TV in the hall, which all the rooms can hear, in a low volume, obviously. And the kids go to sleep. But listening to the Quran constantly while they're sleeping, when they wake up, that sound of the Quran is already in their mind. So when they hear it in real life, they don't feel like this, you know, what we call nashaz, like they have this feeling like, oh, what is this? Oh, no, I don't want to listen to this. This is only for, you know, for Fatiha when someone is dead.
Mm-hmm.
No, but they have this uns. They have this love and with the Quran. Why? Only because their mind is so used to it. So, for example, if you go to your child and you say something to him in his ears as he sleeps, like, I love you, I love you, I love you, for example, or you repeat a message, that subconsciously, it will have effect. So because now, right now, we're trying to use methods to pass on good things to our children, akhlaqiyat, our children, morals and ethics and concepts that are good, we want to grow in our children. So these are the methods that we use. So we mentioned a few. This is one of them that you should not overlook, that the child, even when he's asleep, he's listening to the things.
Okay.
So sometimes you need to put positive things, and even inshallah, when we talk about this in detail, we talk about what kind of things we should say and what kind of things that we should not say, because sometimes you could use a method, even though you think it's in a good way, but in fact, you, for example, are using, for example, a negative sentence. For example, says, do not do this, that you should not use.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
Okay, yeah.
Because you need to use only positive words,
okay,
nothing with a negative
notation
to it.
Yeah.
So, inshallah, we'll talk about that. So that, the concept of trying to embed messages in our child's brain through sleeping, through the subconscious, should not be overlooked.
But for now, what we know is that it always has to be something positive.
Mm.
Okay, let's take a break now, and we'll be back after the break to further our discussion. Don't go away.
Ya
Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. And so we're talking about the various methods that we're going to be learning throughout the next episodes. We're giving a summary of each one. We began this episode talking about songs. We talked about the subconscious when they're asleep, and we should always say positive things, and it really affects the child. What is the final method that you'd like to share with us today?
All right, finally, and obviously there are a lot more, but we stop here so we can continue, inshallah, looking at them and thoroughly. Educational instruments. We need to use educational instruments. Right now, alhamdulillah, we have so many instruments to educate our children with. We just need to put them in our advantage. Give you example. Now, pretty much, I would say almost every child has an access to either a phone or a tablet of some sort, an iPad, you know, or something of that sort. They have access to these. Sadly, what our kids are doing with these things, either playing games or watching YouTube. They're not doing anything constructive with it, right? So we need to use the same tools that were created solely to distract our kids and stop their process of learning. And we need to flip that around to them being, you know, learn it and they learn from them. For example, instead of having my child constantly playing game on their phones, or sometimes they take your phone if they don't have one, and they force you to install a game for them. So instead of that, you say, you know what? Yes, sure, I will let you play a game, but for example, also play that game. You know, there are a lot of games with, you know, for the mind, to train the mind. There are a lot of Islamic games that you can download. There are a lot of Islamic videos you can make them watch. There are a lot of even, you know, educational apps. For example, I would, with my son, there's a program for teaching them maths from grade, from young grade to grade 12. So I say to him, okay, you need to finish 2-3 tasks in that program. Once that's done, then you can hit your games. And I can see the process, obviously, otherwise he can't access. So I'm like, okay, you finish it, and I will let you. So we need to use these means and these instruments that are in our disposal for our advantage. And sometimes even you have toys for, you know, for young kids, like 2 years old, 3 years old. There are toys that teach them things. You know, they press a button and it will make a sound, like, you know, animal sounds and stuff like that. This is for entertainment. We have the same ones, but for Islamic ways. For example, you hit and says Bismillah. Mm-hmm. You hit a button and says A'udhu Billah. It hit a button and says Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad, or reads ayah from the Quran, and it will make a sound. So something that the child could interact with, and also will teach him. Mm-hmm. So I'm just mentioning a few, and there are many, many more that me and you can use in trying to educate our children.
Should every aspect be Islamic? Like, for instance, a toy can have a melody, or it can have, like what you said, these Islamic. Should every aspect be Islamic? Isn't it too much? Is there any such thing as too much when we're talking about this kind of stuff?
No, see, I don't want to say it's too much, but sometimes the brain has capacity to understand things at a certain amount, and then it drops out. The attention span just drops out. So you don't want to overload things. So there's not such a thing as enough teaching, but there's enough overload. For example, if I want to teach my son Quran, if I make him read for 2 hours, I'm killing him. He will hate the Quran. He will have an opposite reaction. So I would make him learn the Quran for half an hour, 40 minutes max, and then let him play. He can play with his other toys and do his other thing. So he can have toys of whatever he feels like and wishes, but also there are other toys that are educational for him. So you need to keep that balance, not to overload him with Islam to make him hate Islam. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you need to keep that balance. Obviously, he needs to have his other toys, his entertainment toys, and his educational toys.
All right, so that's all the time that we have. Unfortunately, if you missed the program, don't worry, you can always download an archive from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com find the link of Call of Islam Radio and you'll find our show right there with all the episodes ready for downloading. You can also email us at englishradio@irib.ir. That's englishradio@irib.ir. And find us on social media. Simply search at Call of Islam Radio on Twitter, Instagram, Telegram, and YouTube. Until next episode, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Around the world with reporters. Shocking footage filmed on the 18th of June, Iran's election day, shows Iranian expats being attacked outside polling stations up and down the UK. Victims included women and the elderly, the perpetrators, supporters of anti-Iran terrorist groups, including the MEK, communists, and Shah royalists.
Videos released on social media show fanatic protesters hurling Islamophobic abuse and even physically assaulting voters in cities including Birmingham, Manchester, and here in London too.
One victim reached out to tell us about her ordeal.
As soon as I got near the embassy, I was wearing the hijab, obviously, and the crowd started roaring and screaming. And they got louder. As they saw me, obviously, going to vote, calling me names, calling my family names, cursing my mother, my father. I heard a rock hit the ground. I didn't look back because I was shaking at that time as well. One of them said to me, and funnily enough, the policeman was there, but obviously he couldn't understand Farsi. He was telling me if I had a knife, I would cut you in pieces right here, right now. I was so shaking. Yeah. Since then, I've suffered with anxiety since that day. I said to myself, I should have left. But I stood my ground. I said, why should I leave? And the people coming, I said, why are you calling me names? They said, we call you names because you deserve it.
Britain boasts about being a defender of democracy on the world stage. But these violent scenes suggest that the UK failed miserably to protect democratic rights of Iranians inside its own borders. Despite these attempts, Iran's election went ahead with President-elect Sayed Ibrahim Raisi coming out on top. Robert Carter, London.
It's the world's second most populous nation, and the figures of COVID-19 infection cases are rising on a daily basis. The cities are bustling as the country is picking up pace as the world's fastest growing major economies. But in all this hustle bustle and race of survival, an important aspect of life is on stake, and that is mental health. The second wave of COVID-19 has altered the lifestyle of millions across India who now are struggling in silence. Reports suggest more than 70% of those in the age group of 18 to 24 are suffering from some form of depression. Now, the COVID-19 pandemic has ignited the crisis further, as many are facing financial and social hardships. According to psychological experts, economic and social pressures combined with the lack of appropriate mental health facilities is a major reason behind this new epidemic, which has now started exploding due to the coronavirus pandemic. Based on reports, the economic cost of mental illness in India is expected to be more than $1 trillion by 2030.
COVID-19 has impacted a lot. A lot means, you can say, everyone, almost everyone, because one or the other way, everyone has been affected. Whether it's the infection has caused, the mental health, or the other ways, because the businesses has shut down,
Health experts say all disorders are linked to a fast-paced lifestyle, stress, complexities of living, breakdown of support systems, and challenges of economic instability. They say the COVID pandemic has added fuel to the fire with depression, anxiety disorders, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders, and substance abuse being common in most people.
One must go for yoga daily. Yoga, you have to do proper yoga. Then breathing exercises are there. They have to do at least half an hour to 1 hour so that the blood circulation towards brain increases.
COVID-19 lockdowns impacted people from all walks of life and age groups. Now they're finding it hard to deal with consequences of the pandemic-induced lockdowns. Many turn to drugs and alcohol, while others prefer religious therapies and yoga. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Britain's travel industry is frustrated and nervous. Protesting around the country on June 23rd, people whose jobs rely on international travel, now only working at 10% capacity. They want more countries on the so-called green list to save jobs.
It just doesn't make a lot of sense. And then why put some on the green list and then take them off? Like, say we booked a holiday to Portugal. We were supposed to be there this week and we've cancelled it because it went amber and it was going to cost another £1,000 in COVID tests.
The restrictions are now crazy. So I'm stuck in the London, not in the London, in England for quite a long time. And I wish to travel back to my country as I haven't seen my mom for 2 years.
Green means arrivals to the UK do not need to self-isolate, but have to take a test before and after they travel. Amber means self-isolating at home for up to 10 days. And red means quarantining at a hotel paid for by the travelers.
In the past few days, some government officials suggested double-jabbed passengers from amber-list countries could be exempt from quarantining.
We're also looking to see how we can replace the protections that are currently there with the restrictions, with protections that come from the vaccine, with respect to international travel as well. But it is more difficult freeing up international travel.
And difficult it will be when it comes to the willingness of other countries to let British tourists in. Germany has called on all EU countries to make British travelers quarantine on arrival to slow the spread of the Delta variant. All this as the UK recorded more than 16,000 new COVID cases Wednesday, the highest figure since early February, most of them caused by the Delta variant first discovered in India. There were also 19 deaths. The travel industry is yet to react to the government announcement. But with countries moving up and down the UK government's list, British travelers have to think again before they take a gamble. Saeed Puriza, London.
As anti-Westminster sentiment continues to rise, another part of Britain is entering the fight to break away from the UK. Cornwall, located on the southwest of the island, is witnessing the start of a new pro-independence advocacy group which aims to revive a lesser-known campaign for Cornish independence.
All Under One Banner's Curnow is the latest branch in a wider organisation which already has roots in Scotland and Wales. In both countries, All Under One Banner has achieved significant success in opening up the debate on independence. Locals in Cornwall are hoping to achieve the same.
Many Cornish people who are recognised as a Celtic minority have various grievances with the English-centric London rule, including a lack of funding and a systematic destruction of an ancient culture.
That's a good way of explaining it. We're a long colonised place, possibly longer than the Welsh, who also probably feel that they've been colonised as well. But we've recovered that history, and that's one of our greatest successes. And the greatest challenge now is decolonising the history and explaining it to Anglo-Saxon ears.
In past campaigns, activists have been branded as nationalists who hate the English, a claim rejected by locals.
But no problem with the English or with any other nationality at all. What I have a problem with is the way that possibly we are represented through them. And the way sometimes we are talked down to and treated by them. But no, there's no problem at all. We have so many friends from all over the world down here.
For now, Cornish independence is a minority view, but lifelong campaigners believe things are changing.
I think we're already getting there in terms of greater autonomy, understanding the need for it. The next question is how to get it, and obviously there are political ways of getting it, but there's also a need for people to go out and campaign for it.
The idea of Scotland or Wales breaking away has sent shivers down Number 10. This latest development in Cornwall will surely only worsen Downing Street's fears. Robert Carter, London.
The US Justice Department committed a new flagrant violation of the freedom of the press and blocked several regional outlets' websites, including the Yemeni channel Al Masira and Iran's Press TV, claiming they are linked to what it calls Iranian disinformation efforts. Yemenis condemned this move, saying it proves that the US calls for freedom of speech are lies.
The seizure of some of the websites affiliated with the resistance front comes amid the media war. The Saudi-led coalition has been trying since the beginning of its war on Yemen to cover up its crimes committed against Yemenis and to mislead world public opinion.
Yemen's Ministry of Information said the U.S. government seizure of a few websites confirmed the strength of the media of the resistance and proved that these websites revealed the true face of the U.S., including its participation in the brutal Saudi war on Yemen.
We condemn the seizure of some websites affiliated with the resistance front. This move shows that these websites have been strong enough to influence the American public opinion by releasing the realities on the ground. It reveals the falsehood of American claims about democracy and freedom of speech. Certainly, there are solutions to this blocking, and the websites will be running again.
Ali Ashraei, the manager of Al Masira website, said this move revealed the weakness of the U.S., even though it owns thousands of media outlets.
This step reveals the great weakness that the United States is suffering from, even though it owns thousands of websites, satellite channels, newspapers, and radio stations. However, it was unable to withstand a few channels with limited capabilities which convey the truth as it is and express the opinion of the free people in this world.
Experts believe that this step is part of a media war of the U.S. government against the media outlets of the resistance. They said these attacks will persist and the resistance access should be ready for further violations.
Yemenis say the freedom of speech is a fundamental right for all free people of the world, and the United States has no right to deny individuals or communities this right. They believe that such attacks will promote the free media outlets to continue exposing the U.S. policies. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A number of Palestinian prisoners are going on with an open-ended hunger strike to protest their illegal imprisonment without charge or trial under Israel's so-called administrative detention. At least three prisoners insist to continue their strike despite their seriously deteriorating condition until Israel releases them. Among them is 28-year-old Ghadanfar Abu Atwan, who has started his hunger strike almost 50 days ago. After starting his strike, Israel's prison authorities placed him in isolation. Later, he was transferred to Kaplan Medical Center south of Tel Aviv because of his serious illness, and he's being held there under detention.
Of course, when all doors are shut down in the face of the prisoners to get rid of the administrative detention, they have few means to protest and they have to engage in the hunger strike battle, especially that many prisoners' terms are renewed for several times and this without charge or trial. When Ghadanfar started his protest, he was beaten and tortured by the Israeli jailers and he was held in solitary confinement.
Palestinians held a protest in solidarity with the prisoners outside the Red Cross Committee building in Ramallah. The oldest of those taking part is 59-year-old, a senior leader of the Hamas movement, Jamal Tawil, joined in protest over the detention of his daughter, journalist Bushat Tawil. He's demanding Israeli authorities to release him and his daughter. Israeli court had extended Bushra's previous administrative detention order last March. There is also Sheikh Khadr Adnan, prominent leader of the jihad movement, whom is staging his fifth hunger strike, This is the 12th time he has been detained.
Today we are here not only to stand by the prisoners and support them. This is the least we can do against the administrative detention policy. Israel arrests people from all walks of life and different political spectrum. We are in real need to launch a national and worldwide campaign to force Israel to stop this policy that exposes the Israeli authorities and their illegal practices.
The Palestinian Prisoners Society said the Israeli authorities have lately increased the use of administrative detention against Palestinians. The committee said Israeli authorities issued 200 administrative detention orders since the beginning of May. The majority of the hunger-striking prisoners are those who are held arbitrarily under Israel's policy of administrative detention. That's why they put their lives on the line to demand not only their freedom, but an end to the administrative detention policy. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The U.S. Special Envoy for North Korea visited South Korea for talks with both his South Korean and Japanese counterparts. Sung Kim then repeated Washington's desire for dialogue with Pyongyang.
Most importantly, we reaffirmed our two countries' shared commitment to pursuing the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula through diplomacy and dialogue. We took note of the recent statement out of Pyongyang regarding their preparation for dialogue, and we hope to receive a positive response to our proposal for a meeting soon.
U.S. President Joe Biden's new point man on North Korea, however, conditioned any negotiations on U.S.-led sanctions against North Korea remaining in place, which many see as a barrier to kickstarting broader denuclearization talks. Some activists suggest the tension provides the U.S. an excuse to deploy troops to the region and support American weapons producers.
The importance of the Korean Peninsula has increased as the U.S. military pressure and response to China has been strengthened. The traditional diplomatic and security establishment of the U.S. wants to maintain a certain level of conflict on the Korean Peninsula.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un last week told officials at a party meeting to be prepared for both dialogue and confrontation. Pyongyang later responded to Washington's offer of talks with ridicule, suggesting a wrong interpretation would lead to disappointment. The U.S. may be paying more attention to North Korea with the appointment of a special envoy in his five-day visit here to South Korea. The question is whether that will translate into greater flexibility from Washington in terms of offering Pyongyang some sanctions relief as North Korea deals with the COVID-19 pandemic and recent natural disasters. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In less than 2 months, Iran's president-elect Ebrahim Raisi will take over power. And speculations over the fate of the 2015 nuclear deal is now the talk of the town, while there are still major sticking points in the Vienna talks over the revival of the accord. Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif said the discussions are likely to reach a conclusion before the end of President Hassan Rouhani's term in mid-August.
There is a good possibility that we will reach an agreement before the end of our tenure.
In his weekly briefing, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the U.S. is slowing down the process.
Iran and the U.S. still have differences over some of the issues. What's ahead is for the U.S. to make a political decision and lift the sanctions.
Reports coming out of Vienna suggest that the excessive demands of the U.S. and European parties to the deal are to blame for the sluggish talks. The U.S. wants the destruction of Iran's new generation centrifuges in exchange for only a temporary suspension of some of the anti-Iran sanctions, a demand beyond Iran's commitments under the accord. In his first presser as president-elect, Raisi made it clear that the U.S. must lift all sanctions before Tehran returns to its full compliance to the atomic accord. He said he will not allow the talks to become erosive.
The Americans violated the JCPOA and the Europeans did not comply with their commitments. The U.S. was obliged to remove all sanctions under the JCPOA, but it has failed to do so. The Americans should return and fulfill their commitments. I tell the Europeans not to be impacted by the pressure and the foreign policy of the Americans and to fulfill their obligations under the JCPOA.
officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. The nuclear deal has been in limbo for 3 years, since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. In a tit-for-tat, Tehran adopted a stepwise suspension of its own nuclear commitments. The last remedial step involved ramping up the purity level of enriched uranium to 60%, way above the 3.67% cap set by the deal. The Iranian Foreign Ministry hopes the Vienna talks will conclude before Rouhani's term is over. Observers say this scenario is the best for the U.S., and any foot-dragging means the talks will have to continue with the new Iranian administration, which maintains a tougher tone toward the U.S. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's AB Home and several lawyers have filed a complaint against Mölnlycke Healthcare, a Swedish medical device company, over its refusal to sell medical products to Tehran under U.S. pressures. Mölnlycke Healthcare refused to sell Iranian EB patients' medical care items they needed, including Mepilex dressings. Several children in Iran who suffered from epidermolysis bullosa lost their lives due to the lack of urgently needed medical equipment, and some others were hurt by severe physical injuries, including amputation. Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has resulted in cutting Iranian patients' access to necessary medical items.
Since May 2018, that the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the JCPOA, up to May 2019, a number of children suffering from EB died only because they did not have Mepilex dressings. I want to tell those who claim to be defenders of human rights what has been the crime of this 37-day-old baby who died of the disease only because we did not have Mepilex dressings as a result of the U.S. sanctions.
The move has deprived EB patients, also known as butterfly patients, of essential medical items, killed many of them, especially children, and inflicted serious physical injuries, such as amputation, to some of the patients. The complaint seeks to protect the victims of the open violation of human rights committed by the Swedish company and prevent similar criminal measures.
The Iranian Center for International Criminal Law, an NGO based in The Hague, has submitted a complaint to the Swedish National Contact Point stating that the Swedish company had breached the OECD guidelines by failing to undertake appropriate human rights due diligence, adversely affecting the human rights of EB patients in Iran and failing to remedy its impact. The lawsuit calls on Swedish National Contact Point to hold the company accountable and take action to compensate for the losses Iranian EB patients have suffered and to resume trading with Iran.
Nearly 30 Iranian EB patients, mostly children, have died since Mölnlycke stopped selling its dressings to Iran, saying that for EB survivors, the pain has increased by 70%. Iranian officials have repeatedly blasted the U.S. for imposing sanctions against the country, stressing that such inhumane sanctions have intensified the sufferings of kids with no access to special medicines for incurable diseases. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
For decades, U.S. military operations have been contaminating the Pacific region with toxic substances, including plutonium, dioxin, and VX nerve agent, says John Mitchell, the investigative reporter for Okinawa Times. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Tim Sharrock, writer. This article is published under the heading Toxic Legacy of U.S. Military in Pacific. Stay tuned for more. John Mitchell, the investigative reporter for Okinawa Times, has spent years documenting the Pentagon's brazen use of the Pacific as a testing site and dumping ground for dangerous weapons. Wherever the United States military goes, it contaminates and damages the environment and human health, he says. He warns that the proposed U.S. military expansion in the Asia-Pacific, its largest since the Vietnam War, will aggravate an environmental disaster caused by 75 years of American wars and intervention. The Pacific Islands have been militarized since the Second World War by the American military and are now the edge of the American Empire, he said. They suffered in the past and will inevitably suffer in the future. Mitchell's recent book, Poisoning the Pacific, the U.S. military's secret dumping of plutonium, chemical weapons, and Agent Orange, explored this largely unknown legacy. Based on hundreds of declassified U.S. documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act and interviews with U.S. veterans and whistleblowers, it documents the Pentagon's use, testing, and storage of chemical, nuclear, and other weapons of mass destruction, WMD, in the Pacific, and the disastrous impact of its flawed handling and storage of such weapons. For decades, U.S. military operations have been contaminating the Pacific region with toxic substances, including plutonium, dioxin, and VX nerve agent, Mitchell explains in his introduction. Hundreds of thousands of service members, their families, and residents have been exposed, but the United States has hidden the damage and refused to help victims, he added. The dangerous lurch toward military confrontation in Asia underscores Mitchell's concerns. The U.S. Indo-Pacific Command recently unveiled to Congress that it is seeking $27 billion in additional spending to station additional troops and weapons to counter what it claims is a growing military threat from China. The plans, which also draw on $4.6 billion appropriated by Congress for its Pacific Deterrence Initiative, include a precision strike missile network on the island chain running from Okinawa to the Philippines, the first U.S. Marine base in the Pacific since the Korean War, a missile defense system on Guam, and a radar system on Palau in the Marshall Islands. The Pentagon is also seeking funds to reorganize the 27,000 Marines based in the Pacific region into small units into Guam, Japan, and Hawaii that can operate inside the range of Chinese rockets. The harm that could follow from this expansion can be seen in Okinawa, the focus of much of Mitchell's book. It houses 70% of the total number of U.S. bases in Japan, where 50,000 American troops make up the Pentagon's largest overseas contingent. Through his tenacious reporting, Mitchell has uncovered story after story about the use and misuse of WMDs on the island prefecture, which was occupied by the U.S. military after the bloody battle for Okinawa in 1945 and handed back to Japan in 1972. In 2011, Mitchell was the first reporter to interview U.S. Air Force technicians on Okinawa in charge of the storage of nuclear weapons, which included over 1,200 warheads at Kadena and Naha Air Force bases as well as at U.S. Army ammunition dumps in Chibana and Hanoko. He also broke stories about the U.S. testing of biological weapons and its storage and transshipment of Agent Orange, the defoliant used over Vietnam on Okinawa. His reporting extends beyond the Cold War. Mitchell uncovered the U.S. military's accidental use of depleted uranium rounds at an Okinawan live fire range in 1995 and 1996, its dump of radioactive waste into sewers beneath U.S. bases in mainland Japan in 2011, and hundreds of recent environmental accidents at U.S. bases on Okinawa, that were not reported to Japanese authorities. His book also describes years of high decibel noise pollution from the American jets flying near residential areas in Okinawa. Such long-term exposure is a serious health risk that can cause heart problems, disrupt sleep patterns, and damage cognitive skills in children. One Japanese university study estimated that noise from Kadena was responsible for an average of 10 deaths a year, with 17,000 people suffering from disrupted sleep. The U.S. military presence on Okinawa is an environmental justice problem. That's what the American people must understand, Mitchell said. Earlier this month, the importance of U.S. bases to America's Pacific strategy was underscored when Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga was the first foreign leader to meet with President Joe Biden at the White House. In a joint statement, the two leaders affirmed their ironclad support for the U.S.-Japan military alliance and agreed that Japan would complete construction of a new U.S. Marine Air Base at Hanako in northern Okinawa as the only solution to replace the unpopular Futenma facility. But as Mitchell points out, the U.S. military is building the Hanako base, the scene of daily demonstrations upon a pristine coral reef. Their environment has been decimated by the American military, he said. The Pentagon, through U.S. Forces Japan, denies most of Mitchell's claims. The statement that the U.S. does not clean up contaminants is simply false, a U.S. FJ public affairs officer wrote in a lengthy email. The GOJ, that is, the government of Japan, has never indicated to the U.S. in any bilateral forum that the Okinawan environment has been decimated. The American response to environmental spills is some of the most aggressive in the world, the PA officer added. The health and safety of everyone in and around U.S. installations is one of our top priorities, and we take matters of environmental stewardship very seriously. Mitchell has also reported extensively on water pollution on U.S. bases. During 1960s, he said the water near Kadena was so contaminated that it literally could be set on fire. In his book, he documents 650 environmental incidents between 1998 and 2016 at Kadena, largely caused by leaks of fuel and firefighting foam. These incidents have ranged from small fuel leaks of only several liters that stayed on the base to large spills discharging tens of thousands of liters of fuel and raw sewage into local rivers, he writes. Military incompetence has repeatedly endangered local water. More recently, Mitchell documented severe water contamination in drinking wells around Yokota Air Base, the headquarters of U.S. Forces Japan, near Tokyo, where American presidents and other senior U.S. officials land when they visit Japan. In 2000, officials from the Tokyo Metropolitan Government found no evidence the pollutants came from inside the base. But Mitchell argues that Japanese government reports carry little weight because its officials are prohibited from entering U.S. bases to carry out inspections. The problem, he contends, is the U.S.-Japan Status of Forces Agreement signed in 1960. Thanks to this agreement, the American military does not need to clean up contaminated land, he said. They do not need to allow Japanese officials to inspect the bases. In contrast, in the United States, you can go to EPA webpages and find out what bases are contaminated with what. About the SOFA clause that prevents Japanese officials from inspecting U.S. bases, USFJ responded with a qualifier. While the basic language of SOFA has not changed since its inspection, States. Both of the U.S. and Japanese governments agree that the agreement works well to serve the interests of the two countries. In concluded, the commander of U.S. Forces Japan is designated as DOD lead environmental component for Japan and therefore will ensure U.S. military operations are carried out in a responsible manner that will protect the environment now and for future generations. Statements like that, along with the lack of U.S. press coverage, reflect the disdain on the part of the American elite towards Okinawa, Mitchell said. Most American newspapers don't report about these daily injustices to the people of Okinawa. They don't report about the contamination. They don't report about the weapons of mass destruction. To make the situation worse, the American military has dismissed the testimony of servicemen, saying they're mistaken or were lying, he said. So documents are vital.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining me again on today's episode of The Lantern. Today's discussion is regarding the importance of keeping promises. We're going to listen to a short story regarding this matter. Just brace yourself. It's like a sap story. A little romantic, probably, bridged from an Indian movie. But nonetheless, it has a moral. So let's hear it and we'll be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, salam and so welcome to your program, Lantern. We have another special story for today. Let's listen to it. The title of today's story is Fulfilling a Promise. Ever since the beginning, the girl's family members disagree her relationship with the boy because of the family background. Later, the boy graduated from university. He planned to further study overseas, but before he left, he proposed to the girl. I don't know how to say nice words, but I do know that I love you. If you agree, I'm willing to take care of you the whole life. About your family members, I will work hard to convince them and agree on us. Marry me, will you? The girl agreed, and her parents, looking at the effort shown by the boy, agreed with them. Finally, before the boy goes overseas, they were engaged. The girl stayed back in the hometown, stepped into the working society, whereas the boy continued his study overseas. They maintained the relationship through telephone and letters, although time is difficult to get through with, but both of them never give up. One day, the girl left home for work as usual on her way to the bus stop. A car lost control and knocked her down. As she awoke from unconsciousness, she saw her parents and realized how seriously she got hurt. Looking at her parents with their faces got all wet by their tears, she tried to comfort them. But then she found out that she can't even spell out a word. According to the doctor, the injury affected her brain and that caused her to be mute for the rest of her life. Later, the girl discharged from hospital, returning to her home. Everything was still like before. except that the phone ring has turned into the worst nightmare of hers. Ring after ring, continuously stimulating her pain, but she couldn't tell the boy. She didn't want to be a burden to him, and wrote him a letter telling him she no longer wanted to wait. The relationship between them ended, and even returned him the engagement ring. One day, her best friend tell her that the boy's back. The moment she wanted to ask her best friend, the boy appeared in front of her. With an unfamiliar sign language, he told her, "I spent more than a year's time to force myself to learn sign language in order to tell you I have not forgotten our promise. Give me an opportunity. Let me be your voice. I love you." Looking at the slow sign language by the boy and the engagement ring he gave back to her, she finally smiled.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Gentlemen, my discussion today I humbly address toward you. When you make a promise to a girl, make sure to keep it or die trying. Not just to a girl, but I think promising something to a girl under the romantic influence of our biological needs is one of the more exciting promises that we get to make in our lives. We promise things to our children, to our colleague, to our boss, to our neighbor, to our parents, to our friends. Those are just, you know, we see it as a part of life, but when we get to promise something to a person we are romantically interested in, it gives us that rush of adrenaline and, you know, kind of gives us a purpose to wake up every morning because we're looking forward to moving one step closer to fulfilling that promise we've made to our beloved. And it's a beautiful thing. I'm not here to belittle it or discredit it in any way or form. It's a very good thing. I think Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has blessed us with love and to a degree romance so that we can taste the sweetness of life and through that better ourselves. And it is through this earthly material love that we truly understand the love for the Almighty. Often when we read poetry, especially Persian and Arabic poetry, because a lot of these poets were mystics and spiritual wayfarers like Hafiz and Maulana, or also known as Rumi, their poems talk about the earthly lover, but what they mean is a divine love, right? Or in the case of Layla and Majnun, whose story is infamous, and Eastern and Western people all know about it. The love between Layla and Majnun, or the love Majnun has for Layla, the love that drove him mad and altered all his senses and made him obsess over Layla, is actually a reflection, a manifestation, or a metaphor, a symbol, a symbolic for the love, the divine love for the Creator, subhanahu wa ta'ala. In any case, the point is that love is a beautiful thing. It is an essential part of every human being's life, the need to love and be loved, especially by a significant other. It gives us meaning, it gives us purpose, it makes us feel valuable, wanted, important, and all of that is integral to character building and it benefits our self-respect and self-esteem and confidence. And it's natural, it's biological, it's got to be there. Allah put it there for a reason. But still, we shouldn't miss the point, right? We shouldn't miss the point that it's not the objective, it is just the means. And if, as a gentleman, you make a promise to a lady, a promise to make her happy, a promise to take care of her, a promise to love her, cherish her, protect her, provide for her, be there for her, support her, you know, be a shoulder for her to cry on, hold her when she's sad and miserable and heartbroken. If you promise her those things, first and foremost, create the capacity within yourself to provide her with that. Because what we need to understand is the love we have for someone is Allah's trust. It's an amana, right? It is not ours to abuse and mistreat and twist and turn in whatever shape or form we want. Love is a sacred thing. And this earthly love that we have for our fellow human beings, whether it's platonic or romantic, is a speck. It's a reflection of a divine love for our Creator. Because we're material beings, He wants us to experience it on a material level first. And then through that, our spirituality must grow, right? We have to be able to channel that love properly to give it a spiritual hue and a godly direction so that that love could fulfill its objective. Otherwise, it's just another page out of a romantic novel. And then what? This is the real life, and we are not Darcy and Elizabeth. We are real human beings with hearts, but mostly with spirits. A spirit that was once part of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. I'm not saying that Allah can be partialized and compartmentalized and, you know, divided into sections and a section of it. Well, no, that's not how Allah works. He's one in His existence. I'm just saying that He blew into us. He embodied His spirit in us. We're a reflection of God, a manifestation of God. We're more than just poetry and romance and sentiments and, you know, flattery and infatuation. We're more than that. We have a capacity greater than that. But because loving someone and being loved by that person is the sweetest thing one can experience in this world, Allah made it such a profound and huge part of our biological need that so that through that, we can reach a higher purpose and a greater spiritual growth. Thank you for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.